It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios, both of them this week, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Yes, we've both been seen in the same place at the same time, so you can put an end to all those rumors.
That's right. We are not the same person.
So... yeah,
it's good to be back. I've been sick and laid up for a couple 3 weeks, and the new medications have kicking in. And gosh, I feel really happy today. So yes, it's good to be back.
Just to be upright, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, that's true too.
So let's
Mike, you're looking kind of cute. Let's say we drive down a couple hundred miles and get married.
Do we have to go a couple hundred miles? We can't do it here locally.
No, we can't. Yeah, give it time. Give it
gonna
time.
Gonna have to ask Ron Sims about that.
But frankly, I'm in kind of a rush. So, you know, because the test came back positive. So, anyway.
Oh, I thought you were sick.
Well, I was. That was the first clue. Anyway. Welcome to Eat the Airwaves Trash Talk. We did do a seamless transition from the off-air discussion of Martha Stewart's second career as a dominatrix. No,
she's going to need something, you know, when her TV show gets canceled.
She probably already has it. All those clients just waiting and lining up. Anyway, it's been very, very interesting watching all the headlines and the TV chatter and all the rest of that of gay marriage over the last couple of 3 weeks, especially when you're stuck in a hospital room and there's nothing else to watch. And also, for that matter, you know, the Stranger and some of their folks going after Ron Simmshide for not doing the same thing here that mayors have done in Portland and San Francisco,
and in New York State,
and in New York State, and you know, there's an increasing list of these places where same sex marriage has been with or without the court's blessing sanctioned by government bodies, and you know it. And a flood of same-sex couples who've been lining up to take advantage of this. I mean, clearly there is a demand for it. And that is the first clue that all of this is really a tempest in a teapot. That, you know, for example, when I got married in 1981, it was to a Japanese national woman. And this is another long story because we were in Vancouver, B.C., and she didn't have a work visa for Canada. So she was about to get thrown out of the country. So it wasn't exactly like we had planned to get married. But we then followed her to graduate school in Houston, Texas. And I had a devil of a time explaining to Kyoko why it was that only a few short years before we had moved there, our marriage would have been illegal in Texas because the miscegenation laws that were true throughout the South until the late 60s and early 70s banned interracial marriages, that if you had a different skin color from the person that you were in love with, you could not legally get married in just about every state in the South and a few states besides until about 30 years ago. And yet, maybe even 20 years ago, only a few short years after that, it was simply unthinkable to a lot of people. I mean, it wouldn't even have occurred to anybody who didn't grow up in that era or who wasn't already an adult in that era that those kind of laws existed. And I think that's where we're going to be with same-sex marriages in another 15 or 20 years. And the reason is very simple. Same-sex couples are not going to stop falling in love. And now that the barn door has been opened, the gates have been opened, and you know people are seeing on the news and hearing on the radio and reading in print that this sort of thing is possible, and they're saying, well, you know, if it's not if the government is what's sanctioning marriages and that's supposed to be separate from religion, and if we don't ban marriages on the basis that they can't produce kids because we already have infertile people who are couples and people who are past childbearing age and all the rest of that, then why on earth not? And why do we key so many different benefits for government programs on whether people are married or not?
Excuse me.
And so many legal rights. And so, I think it really is a fait accompli, and all of the defense of marriage acts, and the supposed sanctity of marriage, and the threatened constitutional amendment by George Bush, and, you know, all of these pieces of legislation that good Democrats like Patty Murray and Gary Locke have signed off on or voted for, I think another 15 or 20 years, they're going to be gone. And everything between now and then is really much shouting about nothing, because history is moving in that direction. So Mike, if you're willing to be a little patient, I think we will be able to do it down the street in, sooner or later. It might be a little later than sooner, but I think when we see and hear all of those headlines, it's important to remember that this is a process that's only going to move in one direction. And the direction is not a constitutional amendment to deny rights to people.
It's good to have some historical perspective on the whole institution of marriage, too. I mean, in colonial times here in the United States, you know, back in the 1600s and the 1700s, people lived together without state-sanctioned marriage, and they were considered married.
Oftentimes
they were considered married. They didn't have any piece of paper from any government. They didn't even have a clergyman officiating. All they had were people in their community or relatives who got together. They sort of witnessed the ceremony, and then that couple was married, and they had children, and they had inheritance rights and property rights, etc. Yeah. But nowadays, you have to have the piece of paper in order to, visit your significant other when they're in the hospital. Even, you have to have the piece of paper if you want to talk about custody rights. If the two of you separate, you have to have that marriage document. And given that that's the case now, the fact that gay couples who have lived together for decades don't have the same rights that heterosexual couples
is cut
insane.
And dry. Yeah. And if you want to talk
about... It's wonderful to see, too, that people are coming out and just doing what people did 200, 300 years ago. They're just going to get married whether the state cares or not. They're just going to do it whether clergymen are on the bandwagon or not.
And if you want to talk about
it's wonderful to see it happen.
Yeah, it is. And if you want to talk about the historical perspective of religious justification for marriage, recall that 200 or 300 years ago, women were considered literally the chattel of men. Once women entered into marriage, they had no legal rights of their own. They were essentially considered property.
Although that's varied historically.
That's varied historically, but it was justified by the Bible in many areas. Mm-hmm. The ban on interracial marriages was justified by the Bible.
That has varied too. In some places interracial marriages have been allowed and then not allowed, etc.
Well, I mean almost everything.
So it changes according to custom what people want to do at certain periods of time.
Almost everything has been that's been justified by the Bible has varied over time.
That's true. But
even in many parts of this country, even if blacks were free, they were not allowed to marry.
Mm-hmm.
In many parts of this country, and that too was justified by the Bible. So a lot of it really is cultural. A lot of it really is political context, and whatever the straight white male heterosexual politicians want to say or do or think, people are going to keep falling in love. This is the direction it's going to keep going, and it's great.
All right,
Mikey.
15 years, and we'll be looking back and laughing. So let's talk about the economy and Alan Greenspan.
Yes. Speaking of cute men with unexplained sex lives.
And his solutions.
I don't know about that word cute.
Well, that's true. Maybe 40 years ago, but no, it's. There was a brief mention, actually, I think, in Counterspin a few minutes ago that the reports of Alan Greenspan's reported accounting of the demise of Social Security were much exaggerated. The actual speech in which he gave it, he talked a good deal more about the trouble that the Medicaid fund was in and Medicare, which is the other major trust fund expenditure of government. But let's talk a little bit about that term trust fund, because along with all of the other ways in which the reported fiscal catastrophe that is Social Security has been wildly exaggerated and exaggerated for a very specific partisan purpose of trying to forward the idea of privatization of Social Security. One of the other reasons that the numbers add up the way they do is that the federal government has been illegally borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund to cover up its general fund deficits. And of course, under George Bush in the last 3 years, those deficits have gone from a surplus, obviously, to record deficits, staggering deficits. And the federal government, in order to even make a dent in trying to mitigate the rise of those deficits, has been borrowing more and more from what is supposed to be a trust fund. That is to say, when we have money taken out of our paychecks and payroll to go into the Social Security Fund, to go into FICA, that money supposedly still belongs to us. It's being held in trust by the federal government to pay back to us, you know, when we retire, when we reach 55, or if we become disabled.
There's supposed to be a barrier, a wall between that and the general fund.
Yeah, there's supposed to be a firewall. The general fund is supposed to be unable to use any of the money that's being held in trust in our part. And for a number of years now, increasingly, it was first, well, we'll just borrow a little bit and pay it back. And then they start borrowing a little bit more. And then they stop paying back quite so much. And they stop paying back at all. And now it's gotten to the point where the general fund has become really quite dependent on borrowing from this massive trust money. And the Social Security tax that we pay out of our payroll is rapidly becoming just one more federal tax. So one of the agenda items, in addition to privatization, here is blurring the distinction between trust funds and regular general fund spending so that politicians and eventually Wall Street can get their hands on that much bigger a pot of money. That is where the crisis is coming from, and it really has not been reported on very honestly at all by a lot of these media accounts.
So it was kind of interesting to hear Alan Greenspan say, oh, we're going to have to increase Social Security taxes in order to cover the shortfall that we're going to have when the baby boomers retire and start drawing on Social Security, when the real issue is, hey, where did all that money go that the general fund just sucked right out of the Social Security Trust Fund, and shouldn't some of that be paid back?
Yeah, and also really, one of the reasons for saying we're going to have to increase Social Security taxes is that's one of the only taxes that elected officials consider tax increases to be palatable on, because most people have the impression that they'll get that money back. If you were just to say, well, we're going to have to have a massive raise in income taxes on the wealthy to cover all of the money that we're spending in the general fund, well, there'd be much more of an uproar, even though they're not paying nearly the share that they did
right.
50 or 30 or even 10 years ago.
Nobody's talking about raising the ceiling on the Social Security tax either. Now, a lot of folks don't know this, but if you make over a certain amount of money, I believe it's about $89,000 now, any money you make over that $89,000 ceiling isn't taxed for Social Security. So rich folks only pay up to a few thousand dollars of Social Security taxes, and then the rest of their income's exempt.
Yeah, which means that as opposed to the income tax, which is a progressive tax, when you talk about raising the Social Security tax, you're talking about raising a regressive tax that falls more heavily on middle and working class people.
Right, and of course, investments are not taxed for Social Security at all. It's only your W-2 wage income that's taxed. So investors who don't have a regular job, they just buy and sell stocks and real estate and investments, they don't pay anything into Social Security.
So those
of course, you can argue that they don't receive anything from Social Security, but at the same time, they generally don't have to receive anything from Social Security.
Yeah, so all those of you who work at Burger King but who make significant amounts of money on the stock market, you know, you can rest easy now.
Well, Wouldn't it be nice if there was some type of prosecution for those that steal from our Social Security funds?
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice instead of all of this attention paid to Martha Stewart? Martha Stewart, let's put her in a little bit of perspective.
Oh,
here.
Yes, shall we?
We should. She's been actually found guilty of lying and obstruction of justice, etc., for having done a little bit of insider trading that involved about $200,000 worth of stock. Now, if we put her against someone like Bernard Ebbers, former CEO of WorldCom, who was charged this week in the WorldCom scandal, someone who's responsible...
A headline you may have missed.
Yeah, someone who's responsible for billions of dollars in fraud.
Billion with a B.
Billions with a B. And responsible for driving up the stock price of a company that investors, including little mom and pops who put their money into a 401k or an IRA, investors who bought WorldCom stock and whose investment is now worth nothing, this man is going to go on trial. And here the media is so obsessed with, oh, Martha, you know, how much time is she going to get, et cetera. As far as I'm concerned, she could get 6 days in jail and I'd be happy. Bernard Ebbers, in comparison, ought to get 60 years.
Yeah, and if you want to talk about Martha Stewart comparisons, George Bush, when he was back, our president, the 43rd president of the United States, back when he was playing around with daddy's money and daddy's friend's money at Harkin Energy, was credibly accused of insider trading on a scale that is actually quite a bit larger than Martha Stewart's. If you're going to send Martha Stewart to jail, you should have sent George Bush to jail.
Yeah, he ought to be on trial.
Yeah, but it really is, speaking of George Bush and people's retirements going south through CEO and insider trading. Of course, we talked at the time a couple of years ago in this program about how all of the accounting reforms that Congress pushed through and all the rest of that were a farce. But, you know, if you want to talk about this coming election and the issue of jobs and the fact that there are still a lot of people that do not have jobs in our supposed recovery, the numbers of which came out again yesterday and did not look nearly as promising as they have in the past few months.
Yeah, the Bush administration's been estimating that we need about 300,000 new jobs every month. We had 21,000 new jobs in February, and those were not in the private sector. They were government jobs.
Yeah,
zero job growth in February.
Yeah, George Bush has actually been creating a lot of new jobs in the federal government in the last 3 years. But beyond that, the number of people who were affected by joblessness in this country is pretty substantial. It's, you know, several million people, but it pales next to the number of people who have lost significant chunks of their 401ks or retirement funds in the last 3 years.
And we're not talking about
the bursting of the bubble, through people like
Bernard
companies like
Ebbers
WorldCom
and Kenneth Lay,
yeah, exactly,
of Enron.
Yeah, you know,
all of
those folks have really, really crippled people economically over the last 3 years, and we need to remember that in this election.
Right, we're not talking about 30 and 40 year old people. We're talking about people who are just on the verge of retirement, or who have recently retired, who saw their savings go from something that would sustain them down to something that's not going to sustain them. And a lot of them have had to go back into the workforce. So you look at people being laid off, and you look at the economy being low, and you say, well, it's not just unemployment. It's the fact that there are more workers in the work pool because of this financial collapse that we've been through. And guys like Bernard Ebbers and Kenneth Lay and George Bush and the Republicans who were quick to help these corporate guys get where they were and do what they did.
Yeah. So as Ronald Reagan said once many years ago, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
Good question.
All right. Quickly, if we could hit on Haiti. The U.S. is kind of hitting on it.
Yeah, it is. And I think we're going to find, as we found with Venezuela 2 years ago, that the U.S. involvement in what has amounted to a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide is going to be much, much more substantial than the initial reports bore out. I won't go into the history right now. Eat the State actually started as a mock-up in 1994, and its very first mock-up issue talked about the United States trying to get rid rid of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti, that he was a populist priest who had had the widespread support of Haiti's poor, and that scared the heck out of the United States, and it's taken 10 years for them to get him out of power without their fingerprints, obviously, all over it. What I really wanted to talk about today was how Haiti is in many ways a dress rehearsal for the much bigger, in Washington's mind, effort to get rid of a democratically elected president in Venezuela, that there's a recall petition campaign underway, courts are going to rule on the validity of it shortly as to whether the democratically elected Hugo Chavez will have to face a recall election in Haiti. That recall election is being spearheaded by Venezuela's business ruling elite class. And some very, very interesting connections. One of the most prominent of those business leaders, a billionaire named Gustavo Cisneros, who controls much of Venezuela's media in the same way that Silvio controls Berlusconi controls much of the media in Italy. This is a guy who has been working very closely with Henry Kissinger and associates. You have the National Endowment of Democracy, that shadowy outfit out of Washington that has done so much to undermine democratically elected governments in Central America and Eastern Europe. They have, it turns out, they put over $1 million into the April 2002 coup in Venezuela and to the people involved in it in Venezuela. They have spent another nearly $1 million since then putting money into the recall campaign, into the labor short stoppage in the winter of 2002-2003. There is a concerted effort underway, a diplomatic effort, a financial effort, an institution-building effort by the United States to try and get Hugo Chavez out of power in Venezuela, particularly with Venezuela's oil supply that's considered extremely strategically important. And then diplomatically, Venezuela has been very important with Lula da Silva in Brazil in building a global South coalition that has been an impediment to the IMF, World Bank, Washington D.C. effort at neoliberalism and open and free markets and exploitation of resources in the third world. And Brazil is the real prize here. The democratic grassroots populist movement that has swept South America in the last 3 years is really what Washington D.C. is going to war against. And what we've seen in Haiti in the past 3 weeks is in many ways a dress rehearsal for the much larger battle that Washington wants to fight to the south.
All right. And finally, this week in Iraq, Maria.
Yeah, just a couple of things happened this week in Iraq. We had the multiple simultaneous suicide bombings on Tuesday in Karbala and Baghdad during a Shiite religious festival that killed over 200 people and wounded more than 500. Now, there were no U.S. or Iraqi police. A lot of reporters noticed this. There were no U.S. troops or Iraqi police on either the day of the bombing in these areas or in days after. And so that has made the Shiites really, really angry. And it's also spawned the formation or the reformation of a lot of Shiite militias in order to patrol the religious areas and to cover security issues there.
Can you say civil war?
Yeah, it's another aspect of what the CIA was talking about when they said that Iraq is ripe for civil war when you have these situations happen and then you have these groups reforming or forming up new militias. Now, in the meantime, the U.S. has not got a clue who was responsible for these bombings. Now, there's been a lot of talk in the press about this guy, Abu Musab Zarqawi. He's the guy that the Bush administration held up back before the war as Saddam Hussein's link to al-Qaeda. He's a Jordanian who was supposedly undergoing medical treatment in Baghdad under Saddam Hussein. But all of that stuff's becoming less and less clear. A lot of these U.S. Official statements about this guy Zarqawi, they've had to go back on some of the stuff that they've said is that he was a close high-ranking associate of al-Qaeda, and now it has become clear that he maybe did a little training in a camp in Afghanistan, but it wasn't an al-Qaeda camp, or maybe he has a little link to al-Qaeda, or maybe he wants to be an associate of al-Qaeda. Nobody's quite sure. The U.S. said in the past week or two that they caught a guy who had a letter from Zarqawi to al-Qaeda that says he wants to wage a Sunni fundamentalist jihad against Shiites and Kurds and U.S. troops in Iraq. However, other terrorism experts say, no. Zarqawi is linked to Ansar al-Islam, which is a Kurdish fundamentalist group. So there's an inconsistency there. And then al-Qaeda sent a letter to the British newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi denying any link at all to this week's bombings in Iraq. And Al-Quds is a newspaper in the UK that has received several dispatches in the past from al-Qaeda, verifiable dispatches from al-Qaeda. And then finally, a group of 12 anti-U.S. militias, most of them Sunni fundamentalist militias, issued a document this week that claims that Zarqawi is dead and that he was killed in a U.S. bombing last year, and then his family verified that they haven't heard from him for 4 months. Now, Brigadier General David Rodriguez, he's a spokesman for the Joint Chiefs, told Congress, quote, "There is no direct evidence of whether Zarqawi's alive or dead at this point." Meanwhile, Paul Bremer is claiming that foreign terrorists were responsible for the bombing, but Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, who's actually on the ground in charge of the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad, said, no, that's a misconception that foreign terrorists are responsible for this. It's a homegrown insurgency. Yeah, so truly, yeah. The U.S. has not got a clue.
The conception actually is that foreign terrorists are now occupying the country, and Paul Bremer is running the show. But
that's not true.
Yeah.
And then the bombings coincided, too, with the supposed passage of a constitution. We talked about this a little bit last week. Well, that constitution, it turns out, is not actually going to be signed this week. There are some Shiites on the council who are saying, well, this isn't what we agreed on. we don't like this draft. And after all, it's not really a complete draft anyway, since the U.S. had said, okay, approve what you guys can agree on, and then we'll make changes later. So we'll see. The Constitution is still a document they're trying to hammer out, and they're not quite there yet.
Apparently, we're trying to hammer it out a little more in this country, too. With that, we're unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Well, it's basically a figment of your imagination these days. But we will have a new issue out this coming week. It's found free of charge in places where you find free periodicals and bookstores and cafes and in friends' bathrooms and places like that. You can also find it free on the web at www.eatthestate.org. All the back issues are there, too. And if you would like to donate to our largely volunteer effort, or if you have story trips or ideas, or you'd like to volunteer or help with the distribution or layout or photos or whatever it is, our voicemail is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at area code 206-903-9461.